Welcome, everyone, to the High Existence Podcast. I'm here with Eric Dorkinson. He is a writer, entrepreneur, investor. He's the author of one of my favorite books of all time, The Almanac of Naval Ravikant. I recommend this so often to so many people because it is so useful and wise, applicable. We've actually featured it in the Stairway to Wisdom here at High Existence, and for very good reason. And a little bit about Naval for anyone who doesn't really know who he is. He's an ultra successful investor. He invested early in Twitter and Uber and about 70 other exits, I believe he has. So he's done really, really well for himself. But all of his sort of wisdom and insights that he sort of left scattered around, what Eric's done is a major service. By collecting all of those, gathering them into one single book that's super accessible and useful and valuable. And so I'm going to be talking to him mostly about that. But he's also got some really cool stuff going on of his own. He's sort of taken these ideas and leveraged them for his own career and done really well for himself doing exciting things. So welcome, Eric, and really glad to have you on.
Thanks for having me. I'm honored. And thanks for having me here to blush through that whole intro.
Right. It's always strange, sort of like just doing the intro and just sort of having to sit there while somebody says all these great things about you, but they're all true. So
no, I appreciate it.
You're probably the best person to tell listeners a little bit more about who Naval is, because you're much more intimately acquainted with him. But you also cut down the original draft of this book from about 600 pages down to a much leaner version. So I want you to also tell us a little bit about that choice.
Yeah, I mean, the very first concept for this book was like, hey, I'll throw some like transcripts together, like a couple pretty like quick and dirty kind of thing. It'll be a 3-month project. And then as soon as I kind of had, you know, I just tweeted this idea and Naval retweeted it, and a few thousand people were like, oh my God, yes, please do this. And Naval was like, I'm happy to support, you know, here's everything you need and to get going. I was like, oh, okay. Like this is, I will now give this like maximum effort. And it was just immediate scope creep to like, you know, here's 100 sources. Here's a million plus words of source material. I'm going to spend 3 years on this thing. And the first version of it that I built was like, it was almost like Poor Charlie's Almanac. It was like, you know, it was hundreds of pages. It was a comprehensive, like everything that Naval had ever said categorized. And I went, and as part of the process of trying to like publish this book, I haven't written a book before. And so I did like a peer review process, and I just gave this an early manuscript to probably 20 friends who were kind of all over the world or readers or people who were interested. My mom was on the list, like, you know, everywhere from college students all the way on up. And I got great feedback on certain sections, but almost everyone skipped some piece of it. And there was like this overarching feeling of like, oh, I feel bad because I gave up at some point in this book, even though you told me I could skip around. And I thought that was a really interesting observation. I was like, yeah, man, I don't know that I feel, even if I really enjoyed what I read, I don't feel great about books that I haven't finished. So I cut a lot of stuff that was, and when I say cut, another piece of that realization was just putting it out on the website. Like it doesn't go to waste. It's just only accessible to the people who like finish the core book, really love it, and want to go sort of choose their own adventure through more of Naval's ideas. There's a whole kind of decision-making process around that, but it was a long journey to get to the book you see now.
Yeah. Well, 3 years. I mean, it was worth it, I think, because it's you can sort of dip in wherever and mm-hmm. look, there's something there. And it's really interesting. And I mean, Naval himself, I mean, he said that he doesn't really read books to completion anymore, like, or right. use it as sort of a vanity metric. Full disclosure, I totally use that as a vanity metric, but I totally sympathize. You know, you don't have to read a book from front to back. You know, there's, you know, if there's a section that interests you, you know, go there first and get what you want, like get what you need. I always say, the best book to read is the book that will help you solve your current problem. If it's the Naval Almanac, as it's called, is like separated into wealth and happiness. So, I mean, if you want to focus on either one of those, just, you know, go to that section. You don't have to, if you're perfectly happy, but you could use a few more dollars, you know, just read that one. So
there's probably not too many people on earth that aren't thinking about either their wealth or their happiness, you know, on a daily, weekly or monthly basis. And I really think there's something in this book that can help almost everybody on earth, kind of no matter where you are or what you're working on. It's a very timeless. And that was some of the criteria that I used when I was kind of whittling away at what got to stay in the final versions. Like, you know, is this still going to be relevant? Is this relevant to as many people as possible? Is this going to remain relevant for 10 years, 50 years, 100 years? So, you know, the thing that'll tell me this is really successful is, you know, I appreciate you recommending it now. I hope you're still recommending it in 10 years. And I hope, you know, you buy a copy for your kids or something like that. Yeah. That is the highest compliment I think a book can get, is getting that kind of like Lindy, like intergenerational timelessness.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, I don't see anyone becoming disinterested in wealth and happiness.
Yeah.
Yeah, I've had enough of that.
Yeah. And some of the, I mean, Naval says like some of these like ancient problems require ancient solutions. Yeah. Just kind of keep getting rephrased for the modern world. And, you know, we're struggling with many of the same things we've been struggling with for a long time. You like to think we keep getting better at it.
Mm-hmm. Well, you mentioned the Lindy effect. And I mean, that's, you know, basically, I mean, if something's been around for a long time, it's odds are it's going to be around for much longer. I mean, you know, and I find, I mean, some of the best books to read are the ones that are thousands of years old. I mean, the Meditations, Marcus Aurelius. I mean, that's experienced a pretty big resurgence, and for good reason. I mean, Seneca,
Art of War is another one. Years ago.
Exactly.
Yeah, Book of Five Rings. Yeah.
Yeah. Perfect. And I mean, this one, absolutely. I mean, it's going to be still relevant, which is awesome. And there's so much in there. And it's funny. I've noticed like other people, not even really affiliated with Naval or mentioning him, mentioned these same concepts and as part of their regular everyday speech, which is pretty, pretty cool. I heard a podcast with Alex Ramosi. He's like one of the really, really well-known marketers. And like, he's at pretty much at the beginning of his career as opposed to like right now. Mm-hmm. But he mentioned something on a podcast, which is basically one of the best insights from the book, I think. He says that, and this is quoting Naval, that desire is a contract that you make with yourself to be unhappy until you get what you want. And that's from memory. I mean, I think about that myself all the time. You know, it's like, when is that not going to be true? I mean, it's always going to be true. Everyone's going to need to hear that. You know?
Yeah. Naval has such a gift for distilling, you know, I mean, on the one hand, there's nothing super, super original about that insight, right? Like that is fundamental Buddhist wisdom. And he says that himself. On the other hand, it is a real skill to compress all of those lessons into six words that you can remember, that stick in your head, that guide your decision-making, that make sense to so many of us. The first time we hear them, you're like, oh shit. Like, yep. Like that solves like a tension or an ambiguity that I've carried with me for years. And like, I can use that tool to now live my life and make decisions better. Like that is an incredible skill.
Yeah. It's interesting when you get to the point where you forget where you've heard something or read something, but it's part of your life that it's just like there was something, I mean, I remember years ago, I mean, I think this is Jim Rohn or something. I've read one book by him years ago, but he said, you can get almost anything you want in life as long as you help enough other people get what they want. And I have no idea where I read that, but it's been sort of a guiding sort of operating principle since then. I mean, I always make it sort of win-win every sort of relationship that I go into, right? Like what's in them, you know? But it's like the whole book that you've put together is littered with that. You know, there's so much in here, which is why I recommend it. You know,
it's great. Thank you. Yeah. No higher compliment than recommending a book. And when people gift it, like that's warm and fuzzies for me. So I appreciate it.
No, there's a lot to go into. Since we're sort of going down books, how far have you made it into at the end? So Naval has like his own recommended reading list. Have you explored that a little bit yourself? Like how far have you gone into his sources?
Yeah, some for sure. I have not. Like there was a moment in time where I was like, oh, I'm resolved that I'm gonna like read all this stuff. I sort of stopped myself from that because I realized, I learned a lot about Naval. I've spent 3 years basically like very, very focused on like reading all of his stuff and working through all of this. And it's like, I don't want to be Naval. Like I want to be me. And so while I have done this sort of like semi daisy chain a little bit, that recommended reading section is probably, I don't know. What do you think? It's 5 years of reading, 10 years. Like if you actually like took it like a real checklist, right?
Well, especially if you go back and reread some of them, because I mean, some books are totally worth a reread. There's a lot of in there. He's been a big intellectual influence of mine.
Yeah. I mean, to be honest, like I mostly like would read through and be like, oh good. Like I should put extra weight on that thing that I've already read. Like I've read a lot of Tlaib, what he talks about. I've read a lot of Feynman. Oh, yeah. I've read a lot of Ridley and Sapiens and Charlie Munger. And so like, I'm kind of like, okay, like cool. I'm not, it actually like explains some of why I identify with him so much. I was like, oh, we have a ton of like shared backlink resources. I'm more well-read on his kind of like nonfiction stuff than the philosophy and happiness stuff that he talks about. Right. But I definitely like, when I pick up those books, like I put a lot of credence behind, you know, I know he's done a ton of reading and filtering in that space. So I'm not super far down the daisy chain, but I would say a fair amount I am. And it is the same thing here that I actually did with Charlie Munger. Like I picked up Poor Charlie's Almanac at, I don't know, 21, and loved that book, you know, read the other Munger books and then read all the books that he said were influential to him. You know, the Walter Isaacson biography of Benjamin Franklin, influenced by Robert Cialdini, more and more of those kind of like basic elementary economics and psychology texts. And you know, that's why one of the first questions I ask people on my podcast is like, who are your heroes? I think it's so revealing. And like, if I say Munger and, you know, Naval and Balaji and Elon, like that tells you a lot about what I value. And then you look at those people and look at their heroes. It's like, okay, it's Benjamin Franklin. It's, you know, for Charlie Munger, it's his grandfather who's a judge. You know, for Naval, there's like some entrepreneur heroes and some sort of enlightenment heroes or spiritual heroes. And it just sort of get a feel for who those people are and how like all, everything that stems back, and you can find, you know, the people that you admire learned it from someone. Right. And you can kind of like work closer to those primary sources and really, you know, build out this really strong kind of robust foundation of understanding, not just understanding what they're telling you, but understanding how they understood it in the first place and who they learned it from, which is super, super valuable.
Mm-hmm. Well, you start seeing like the same names pop up over and over again. Mm-hmm. So it narrows down the list. Like maybe I should, you know, start here. And I mean, reading is like, I mean, we'll talk about leverage, you know, coming up, but reading is like the ultimate, you know, leveraged activity. I mean, from like an entire lifetime of people's experience in just a few hours. There's this guy, Jim Quick, you probably heard of him. He says you can download decades into days, you know, it's sort of like a way of saying it. It's absolutely true. And, C.S. Lewis, he was like, in reading the best books, I become a thousand men yet remain myself, you know? So, I mean, it's that type of thing, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, I mean, you hinted at an interesting exercise there, which would probably be to like cross-reference recommendations from all of the people that you admire. You know, I think Munger is like a very much a shared, sort of resource for like a bunch of people that I admire. And when I meet somebody through that kind of thread of interest, it's like, oh man, we're like definitely going to get along. But to hear that, you know, to hear Richard Feynman recommended by everyone from, you know, Bezos to Musk to, or Andy Grove is not really, not a lot of people know, but a lot of managers that you know and respect Andy Grove. So it is just kind of like, you know, seeing those, you know, it is almost like backlinks of, you know, sort of source recommendations. And you could really stack rank the importance of those once you kind of start to see those patterns.
Mm-hmm. Now, the like a working relationship I've always loved is like Charlie Munger and Warren Buffett, and like just they work so well together and like bouncing off each other. Does Naval, like, do you or Naval have that sort of like other half that you sort of like a contemporary that you work with like that, or is it mostly just like 1,000-year-old dead guys?
No, I think Naval does in that Nivi, Babak Nivi was his co-founder of AngelList. They wrote most of Venture Hacks together. Nivi's name is on most of those posts. Mm-hmm. You know, Nivi is his kind of like co-host when Naval does his podcast. A lot of that is like their conversations. And I think they've been in, you know, a lot of the stuff that they've done together. Mm-hmm. You know,
for people who don't know, what is AngelList?
Oh yeah, sorry. So AngelList is really becoming like the platform of like Silicon Valley in the cloud. Like it is the place that you can go to get a job in a startup. It is the place that you can go to get funding as a startup founder. It's the place So I'm starting a small like early stage venture fund right now, and it's the platform that I use to manage my fund, bring on investors, allocate capital from. It's so it is like the utility behind so much of what happens in the Valley. You know, they help you put together syndicates to manage investments. They help. It is a very long list of subtle innovation that makes all of Silicon Valley tick a little bit smoother. And they had some really, you know, they bought Product Hunt, which is like one of the brands that people might know. They started CoinList and Republic, which are kind of more crypto oriented versions of some of the same infrastructure. It's a really, really interesting story. And actually I did research and curated in the same way, the story of AngelList, like how Naval's life experience led to him founding AngelList, what the early stages of AngelList were like, how it got built into this kind of behemoth that it is, which is a really interesting story involving like lobbyists and regulatory changes and like really strong MVP. I mean, the first thing they did was build a blog, and then they built an email list that was like the MVP of the platform. And then like, it is a really, is a true story of kind of like inch by inch innovation and winning. And it's turned into an incredible business on its own. So that is on the Naval Manak website. One of those things that got cut from the 600 page version of the book.
Yeah.
But if you're interested in startups and those kind of founding stories, it is a very good one that I think a lot of people, is a little hidden in plain sight from people just because it's not like a consumer brand, but a lot to learn from that. You can find that on the book website.
Right on. And we'll include all of this in the show notes too. So, I mean, people listening,
put it in the show notes.
Exactly. Right. That's where you want to go. Lead you right to, Naval Manak. And with AngelList, I mean, he's building in public basically. I mean, doing that, and he's sort of exemplifying, a lot of the principles and things that he's teaching others. I mean, he's doing exactly as he's saying. I mean, he's using accountability and specific knowledge. And I mean, it's massively leveraged opportunity. I mean, he's doing it, which is pretty cool. He's not like an armchair philosopher, you know?
Yeah. I mean, that was one of the really interesting things, you know, he taught us all the frameworks like chronologically only in the last few years, really, like after he kind of achieved all the success, and who knows how clearly he understood them in the moment that he was acting it out. But you can see, you know, I have this whole like history of Twitter. That was one of the things that I went through for the book. And you can kind of see like these, you know, 2010 to 2014, he's like very much talking about the process of building the company and sharing new features. And, you know, he's almost doing like customer support on Twitter and, you know, hitting up investors and bringing them on. But when you read that, the story of the company, you can see exactly the specific knowledge and life experience that he had that led him to start understanding the problem better. Like he had this, kind of like somewhat nasty legal dispute with between his co-founders and his venture capitalists in one of his first companies. And he ended up kind of like getting screwed, but then they took some legal action and they ended up settling and things came about. But like, as a result of that, he got incredibly smart about all of the terms that are involved in a term sheet and the funding mechanisms, and sort of like started blogging about the game theory of venture capital. And that's what placed him in this spot to kind of be like, I understand venture capital very well. I don't want to perpetrate the existing sort of, I don't know, tropes and like the status quo of the Valley. So how do I like innovate this in a way that is friendly to entrepreneurs, but still, you know, represents us as investors? You know, Naval was 32 when he started his first, I think it was HitForge. There was like a incubator that became a venture fund. And that was where he did some of his biggest, you know, Uber, Twitter, Postmates, kind of investments, but he's got a portfolio of hundreds today and still like one of the big sort of successes of his career.
Yeah. Yeah. It's only been recently, like within the last couple of years, that I've really sort of gotten more interested in investing and stuff like that. I mean, it wasn't too long ago. I mean, I didn't know how to calculate like a price earnings ratio, right?
That's as it should be, actually. Yeah. I just wrote a post about like managing attention thresholds and trying to wrap my head around like the opportunity cost of like where you allocate your energy at different stages of like, you know, as you grow your wealth. And it's like investing is totally irrelevant probably until you like are have at least $100,000 net worth. Like focus all your energy on increasing your earnings and increasing your savings. Because the ROI of attention to savings versus the ROI of attention to investing. And then like somewhere as you approach and eclipse like $1 million, it's like, oh wow, like my money can work way harder than I can. And eventually, you know, if you got 10 or 100 million bucks in the bank, it's like, well, I couldn't possibly earn more money than my money is earning for me. It's very interesting.
Two things you said. One I want to jump on now, and one that I want to circle back to is I'll circle back to I'll mention investing first. So
I'm throwing too much at you.
Right? There's so much. It's like the book is like talking.
Yeah.
But with investing, I mean, you're exactly right. I mean, if you don't. Yes, there is, it is a good idea to start early, put in, money.
Absolutely.
Really consistently. I mean, dollar cost averaging is like the most boring, safest, effective thing you can do.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I mean, you're not like nobody's getting rich investing like $50 a month, right? It only compounding really only really, really works once you get into like sort of bigger, bigger investments. And like once you actually are able to put more money in,
Well, I would, the only caveat there is that it's a blend of variables between amount, like besides the principal and the time, right? Mm-hmm. You absolutely can get rich investing $50 a month if you have a 50-year time horizon, and that's the story that's of the $5 million janitor, right? That Morgan Housel tells. Mm-hmm. Nobody's getting rich, in 5 years, but the, long-term compounding. And one of the things it's just so massively counterintuitive to us to remember how that compounding works. Like I keep a compounding table open or near me, like kind of all the time, like keep referencing it. And, I've got like a super nerdy poster of the Berkshire Hathaway, like price to earnings and market cap chart that my buddy Max Olson put together. It like up in my bathroom. So like I see a compounding returns chart every day. And like, you have to work so hard to kind of constantly reinforce the sense that, that those like things that are so microscopically like marginal improvements in the near term have such massive like outcomes over the long run. And it's just so easy as like a weak, fallible monkey brain human to like underweight the importance of that like seemingly irrelevant small positive compounding in the near term. And I just take every effort I can to reinforce that.
Mm-hmm. Well, I remember even like Daniel Kahneman, he mentions all the time, like he is victim to the same cognitive bias and things like that, that he's written about, that he studied, that they gave him the Nobel Prize for, like he's like who he is, and he still gets tripped up by it. And actually, I mean, we'll be talking about leverage more in a few minutes. I mean, that is super counterintuitive as well, or sort of like not obvious. It takes someone like Naval and like you to sort of point out how powerful it actually is and some of the applications, But one thing that you just mentioned that reminded me as well, actually two things. One, you mentioned Morgan Housel, and that is another excellent book for anyone who hasn't heard of The Psychology of Money. It's actually another one that we featured on the Stairway to Wisdom. It's just another one. It's really, really good. But James Clear, Atomic Habits, it's like the definitive book on habits. He says is that you should be much more concerned about your trajectory than your current results. So if you're doing what you're supposed to be doing now, but you're not seeing any results, like that's fine as long as you keep doing it. it will come. I mean, most people forget. I mean, I think Warren Buffett wasn't a billionaire until he was in his 60s or something like that. And it is this like steep curve upwards, and I guess that's not the problem that I have, but people sort of sell the dream of like getting rich in the stock market. Like, but it's like, in 50 years, like you'll be, if you start when you're 25, you'll be 75. You're going to be, stuff in your wheelchair in the back of your Ferrari, right?
Yeah, you'll get rich like the minute you realize that, your life is over and that you didn't need it to be happy anyway. And you've delayed gratification the whole time waiting to be something that you didn't need to be. Naval says it. And I think Morgan says it, there's so much, there's so much wisdom around it that is, to your point on Kahneman, like, just thoroughly ignored because it's hard to swallow or takes constant reminders.
Yeah, it's not obvious. And yeah. Sort of like that leads into one of the other things you said a while back, I wanted to circle back to about you know, teaching the things that you're learning. I mean, I will say that, you know, when you teach something, you get to learn it twice. And I mean, like the best way to learn something is to teach it to someone else. And that was sort of what Naval was doing in those old tweets. That's mm-hmm. what you're doing when you're writing this book. That's what I'm doing when I write these, you know, book breakdowns of these books and reviews. Yeah. And stuff like that. I'm still learning this stuff and I write about it to sort of consolidate that information in my own head. And if I can't write about it and if I can't speak about it, then I don't really understand it. And now, I mean, you've written about it and you can speak about it. So you understand it and you're bringing it into your life now. And your trajectory is corrected. You know what I mean? So it's just, it's a powerful process to get going as soon as you can, you know, just learn from the best as soon as you can and just double down.
And I have found that, I mean, I think you probably learned this in your own way, or maybe it was intuitive to you, but like the more of it I publish, the higher fidelity I learn it to and the higher quality bar mm-hmm. put on like the, you know, you can consider the Almanac like a book report on like learning from Naval's life. And you know, if I was just like, I'm going to listen to this podcast and take notes on what I can learn from Naval, which is like kind of my default nerd mode, I would have maybe listened to it once or twice, like taken some good notes and been like, okay, like maybe I'll apply these, but maybe I'll just keep learning. The fact that I spent 3 years doing it and had to like really, really polish it and put my name on, I probably have read this book 20 times in the course of creating it. I feel like I've built like a mental model of Naval that sits on my shoulder. Yeah. And I can almost predict what he would think about things that he never has expressed an opinion about. I can feel like I can, like they're just, I like almost feel guilty sometimes about how much I've subsumed like some of his ideas into my own and been like, these are my ideas now, which is like how all of us work, frankly. Like we all learned it from somebody else and everything we think we are is like from outside of us at some point. But it is rewarding to then see that like show up in my behavior, be like, oh, like I have actually like, this is all the way in. And I think the reason, part of the way that happens is because of that really high quality bar and the number of reps that I put into it. But I'm only able to get myself to do that by knowing that like I had this cliff of like impending publication, like, you know, looming in front of me.
Yeah. Well, you had that accountability, which is another thing that Naval talks about quite a bit. I remember you were on on Anthony Pompliano's podcast and he mentioned that now he's got Naval basically on his shoulders, like you said, as sort of like he's in his like sort of mental board of directors, you know, sort of making a decision. There's like, what would Naval say, you know? And you read enough books, you study enough people and you listen to enough, you know, podcasts and you have like a group of people that are, you know, much wiser than you and I, you know, just telling you, you know, where to focus.
Yeah. I got Munger on one shoulder and Naval on the other. And it's just like a weird place in my head. So.
Yeah. Right. Oh man. Oh, Naval left out a bunch of stuff from the book. As you say, I mean, you cut it down mm-hmm. 600 pages that it could be to a much more accessible, what is it now? 150 or something like 200.
Yeah, it's about 50,000 words. Okay. I don't know what that, about 200 pages of like the book pages, which is, you know, super variable.
Yeah, I read it on my phone.
Probably 1,000 pages on your phone. I don't know.
Right. Oh man, at least. So he left out a bunch of, or you left out a bunch of stuff. What are some of Naval's thoughts on education that he left out? Because I'm really interested to know more about that.
Yeah. So all the stuff that's available
on your website, anyways.
Yeah, all the stuff I cut is on the website, navalmanac.com. And like you know, Naval is meaningfully more eloquent than I am. So, you know, there's probably more nuance that I might miss in this recap, but, the thing that sticks with me as the most powerful piece of the education is he walks us through this thought experiment of like, imagine that every human being on earth is perfectly educated. You know, there's no law of physics that says we can't all know how to write code or, you know, solder together wires or be hardware engineers. And so like, just imagine for a second what the planet looks like if we all have, you know, master's degrees and practical experience in engineering, robotics, software design, and we have 7 billion sort of like entrepreneurially minded practical engineers. And sort of the way that plays out, at least Naval's projection of it, is like we would basically solve all material issues like within a decade. Like if we had that amount of brain power and energy and in the resources to allocate, like going into that, you know, we'd automate a lot of factories. We'd automate a lot of farming. We'd have, you know, meaningfully better transportation. We'd have the kind of physical abundance that we are truly are getting closer to every year or every decade. Mm-hmm. You know, we have longer lifespans. We have, you know, people are using more energy, which is like a much better sort of measurement of poverty than, you know, dollars and cents and lifestyle. But it's a really, you know, when you think about that and the what is the benefit of, or what is unlocked with great education, it kind of puts you in a, like, yeah, why can't we have that? Or why aren't we better at that? Especially now that we have the internet, right? Like, and then I kind of turn this into like, you know, it seems relatively obvious to me that over, you know, multiple generations, the single greatest, the variable with the largest coefficient in the formula of like humanity's rate of progress is education. You know, like the smarter we are and the better we are at self-educating or educating each other, and the closer we can get to that sort of theoretically perfect educational state, you know, the faster we move towards being multiplanetary, the faster we move towards, you know, energy abundance or, you know, food and water abundance, and the closer we can get to, so many of the things that we aspire to. And I don't know, it's a real unlock to, like, you know, and taking, you know, then Elon Musk's kind of like, you know, where is this against the laws of physics? What are the first principles? Mm-hmm. The internet really makes it obvious that that's possible to reach that sort of level of education, and that it's a, you know, it's a distribution and logistics problem. It doesn't require any, you know, new science to distribute education to that many more people. It's just logistics, which I find quite inspiring. And I hope, you know, more and more people kind of like take up arms against that problem that can help us move closer to it. And I think we're going to see some crazy shit in our lifetimes because of the sort of compounding or the feedback loop between, you know, greater education, a much better educated population, and the rate of progress against some of these technological problems.
Yeah. Nice Hamlet reference, by the way. Take up arms against that, but it's absolutely true. And like, I sort of like, I have this something I stole from Colin Wilson, one of my favorite philosophers. He sort of likens humanity in general to like individual people to like big, like great big jet engines, basically only flying on one, or jet airplanes only flying on an engine, and there's. Mm-hmm. They're not operating nearly to their full capacity and like what they could become in all areas, not just productivity for the sake of, you know, productivity, but just just being like fully, you know, fully here and now, you know. And I mean, I think too, I mean, you mentioned how like the material progress that everyone, like all over the world. And I mean, Steven Pinker, one of my favorite authors, like he's written several books on how everything is pretty much getting better all the time.
Things
he the way he puts it is that like they newspapers, if they were going to accurately tell people accurately the state of the world, they could have ran the headline 25,000 people lifted from poverty today, every single day for the last like however many years, like 50 years or something like that, you know, which is really astounding. And like when I don't know the exact number, but the number of people with like a genius IQ per like in the population, mm-hmm. How many in the bottom billion just aren't being given the opportunities to develop their full intelligence and really sort of like we need to add their intelligence to our own and sort of bring them up and sort of help us solve like our collective problems, right? And
we have generations of lost Einsteins that I hope are no longer lost, and we see people working on this problem. I mean, Andela is doing this with incredible results. I think is their focus on Africa. But yeah, I mean, that's like their tagline, you know, intelligence is equally distributed, opportunity is not. And it's something Balaji has worked on as well, with, you know, 1729 and things like that, this kind of like global spotlight search for, you know, uncommon intelligence and making sure that those people get the resources and attention and, you know, problems that they need to, like, you know, you never know who's going to invent the next, you know, the next steel or Bitcoin or whatever. And those are, you know, those people make deeply disproportionate contributions to the comfort and safety of the rest of humanity. And we should all be interested in finding and resourcing and supporting them.
Mm-hmm. I absolutely. And I think, sort of slaving away to sort of just survive. They're not like real human problems, you know, like they're not problems like worthy of like a fully dignified human being. You know what I mean? Like you should be able to work on more interesting problems, you know, than just worrying about how to survive, you know? And, right. I mean, the internet's changed everything. And I don't think people, even now, I think, you know, we're still early in the internet. I mean, we haven't anything yet, you know, and it's just like the potential that just lies there undiscovered, which is really astounding. And it's not obvious, you know, which sort of like, you know, makes me wonder like how many people are actually aware of this potential as opposed to like how many people I'm aware of it.
Yeah. I mean, we've been saying it for, 20 years now, and it still feels like both eye-rollingly obvious and like we're still underestimating it. I feel like we're constantly underestimating software innovation. We're still underestimating the impacts of the internet. You know, we're not done with the like digital transformations. We're not done with, you know, even spreadsheets becoming SaaS. We're not done. And and the fact that like, you know, blockchains are, I mean, barely distributed, let alone really even finished being developed. You know, that's going to be another 20 to 50 years of innovation. It's going to take us 50 years to figure out what, you know, all of the second and third order effects that, that'll have. There's just so much exciting stuff going on. It's so easy to underestimate it kind of constantly.
Yeah, we're pretty much always doing it all the time. And you know,
it's hard to go about your life just having your mind blown all the time. You know, oh my God, 25,000 more people leaving poverty. Oh my God, like we're living in the age of ultimate innovation. And
exactly. We sell ourselves short, you know, so often. And one of the things, I mean, one of the sentences I loved in the Navalmanac was, I forget exactly where this appears, but he says, what if this life were the paradise we were promised and we're just squandering it? You know, I've always loved that. That's one of my favorites. Speaking about like common knowledge and everything, like how common do you think is knowledge about leverage? I don't think very often. I mean, you ask the normal everyday person, like describe, like give examples of leverage. I don't think most people would be able to do it or at least like in a compelling way. Now, how would you describe it? And how common do you think is that knowledge?
Yeah, I think it's common under some different names, right? Like there are some like kind of, especially in business, there's like some almost folk sayings that are like, that allude to it. You know, it takes money to make money. Yeah. Sure. Your money can work harder than you can. Yeah. You know, the old like E-Myth Revisited thing. It's like, you know, work on your business, not in your business. Like all of these things are kind of like, alluding to leverage. And I think the word leverage is, sometimes kind of trips people up because they either think like, oh, they go straight to like Wall Street financial leverage. Or they think like, oh, you have like power over someone in a negotiation, like that kind of leverage. And this is really neither. This is like an expansion of the simple machine. Like it is the mental modelification of the simple machine, a lever that simply lets you lift more, you know, a lever arm that lets you lift more than you could with direct effort. So I can't lift 800 pounds yet, but I'm going to keep trying. But with the 20-foot lever, that's no problem at all. And you know, if you had a 20-mile lever, you could lift the Eiffel Tower. And if you had a 20-light-year lever, you could lift the Earth, right? Like this is where leverage and compounding are so similar in that they are very counterintuitive. They're very math-based. They can utterly determine, you know, the outcome of your life or explain the extreme outcomes that we're seeing once you kind of have this understanding. But it's so hard to believe that, you know, $50 a month saved today will let you retire a millionaire in 40 years. And it's in the same way, it's so hard to believe that you can look at a building and say, I could lift that, you know, with a 200-foot lever. It just doesn't seem possible. And when you see really long levers, like with comedically small things, you're kind of like, that's incredible. And in the same way, you know, you watch Warren Buffett make one decision or Naval, you know, invest, take one 1 hour meeting, you know, write a $10,000 check and a few years later, collect $1 million. Like that's leverage. And it seems impossible or illegal, depending on your like worldview, until you understand, you know, the compounding and the stuff that comes behind it. But yeah, it's a very interesting mental model. And it was the thing I left the book with the most curiosity about. It's the thing I get the most questions about too. You know, like there's a chapter on leverage. People read that chapter and they're kind of like, I want to read a whole book on this concept. Like where can I go to get more? And I had no resources for them. I had the same hunger for it. And I started reading and collecting and, you know, trying to find things and trying to kind of expand frameworks and find resources and case studies and stuff like that. And that's what turned into the leverage course. But it really started with me just trying to like figure out how to apply this for myself and sort of, you know, get this idea even deeper into my head so that it would become sort of a second nature instinct for me and guide more of my decisions.
Mm-hmm. Now, you and Naval talk about four different types of leverage. Do you want to just say a few words about each one?
Yeah. So we have tool leverage, product leverage, people leverage, and capital leverage. Mm-hmm. You know, tool is pretty simple. Like try to chop down a tree with your bare hands. You're going to have a bad time. Use an axe. It's going to go way better. Use a chainsaw. It's going to go even better. Product, Naval calls it media leverage. I think product is a little bit broader, but potentially a little more confusing, which is fair feedback. We're creating media leverage right now. We're spending, you know, an hour and a half to record this podcast. It will serve, you know, thousands of people in parallel and well into the future, totally on demand. I like to think of that like creating a like little digital clone of us with like a purpose built, a specific purpose. That also incorporates media, also incorporates, you know, writing blog posts, writing books, even writing algorithms, software. There's a little bit of a fine line between like what's media and what's a tool. Like I think Zapier is the tool, but the formula to decode in Zapier is the media, like the knowledge process that you're actually using that tool to describe and act on. Okay. The third being people leverage. So that, you know, the first thing that people think of is employees. It's true. Great. Also includes, you know, freelancers, agencies. I think also includes audience and fans. So not all of it has to be like, oh, people you're paying, but friends, experts, mentors. And again, like there is no negative connotation to leverage. We are all somebody else's leverage. We are all benefiting from trading each other leverage. We are good at different stuff, you know, very like Econ 101 benefits from trade outlook in this sort of context. And then the fourth is capital leverage. So money being the most obvious thing that you can, you know, invest directly or use to trade for any of the other forms of leverage. But you can also look at it like, you know, your car or your spare bedroom are capital of some form, and you can, you know, monetize those or lend them or, you know, give your spare bedroom to somebody who, you know, can help you work. Like there's just so many things you can do when you have a creative outlook and you sort of take full inventory of those types of leverage. And something that I noticed just like a pattern going through these and talking, I mean, I've had hundreds of these conversations with people in the course and in podcasts and friends, and almost everybody sort of inherently is drawn towards or has skill with, you know, one or two forms of leverage. They're usually like totally blind to, like they don't even consider one of the four forms. And there's another one that they want to use, but they don't know how, or they're afraid to, right? So maybe somebody's an amazing manager, but they just don't understand how money works at all. They're terrified to spend any money on better tools or on other people. And they just like, that's a missing piece, or vice versa. You know, they're a really like tool oriented person, but they never want to manage anybody. They don't have business partners. Like we talked about, you know, they don't have a Munger, or a Nivy. And usually like there's some combination of things that you can really unlock a ton of growth when you look at all four of those and really give yourself an honest sort of brick by brick like path towards building all of them out. And that's what we do in the course. You know, that's what all the frameworks and tools and exercises are kind of oriented around.
Mm-hmm. It's almost overwhelming once you start learning about it, and you sort of like, it's like a fireworks display. When you think about all the ways you could, you know, gain these types of leverage and apply them and make so many different areas of your life better, and the compounding effect of making your life better, like improving your experience for every subsequent moment of your life. You know, if you improve it now, You know, it's just the possibilities are almost endless. And I know for me, I mean, it's people leverage that is the one that I'm sort of not reluctant to go all in on, but missing. There's an excellent book called Who Not How by Dan Sullivan and Benjamin Hardy. And it's all about, you know, basically the core idea is that there are people that love to do what you hate to do or are infinitely better at doing things that you're just sort of okay with. And you're much better served hiring those people to do those things and freeing up your own time to work on your own core competencies. And as opposed to trying to do everything yourself. And like when you have that sort of people leverage. So like right now I'm hiring other people to like do the things that I'm like not all that great at, you know?
Yeah.
Naval has this thing too. I mean, he what's pretty cool how he values his time at $100 a minute. And I've like that stuck with me since I first heard it. And like if it's something that he can pay someone to do, then he'll do it. Like if it costs less than $100 a minute, like he'll just, you know, delegate it. And I remember him saying that like he did that way before that was literally true. You know, way before his time was actually worth that much. It was more of a mindset shift, and that sort of opened up, you know, more for him, you know.
Yeah, that's one of the first. It's one of the first exercises we do in the course, and people struggle with it because it's very difficult to. It's difficult to believe that your time is worth, you know, $1,000 an hour. You're like, if that were true, why aren't people paying me $1,000 an hour? Or like, if that's true, why can't I spend $200 an hour on, you know, this person to help? And it's kind of like, you can if you are then recycling your time into that work. And like, there's a lot of variables that go into it, but it's an incredibly valuable way. It gets you to start valuing your time, thinking about how you're investing your time, but both your working time and your leisure time, right? So like, you know, it is not to say like you should always be focused on work to the maximum extent possible. You should always be maximizing like the hourly rate that you have, but it is to say like, you have to value every minute that you have, whether you are choosing to work with that time or choosing to relax with that time. You know, putting a high dollar value on it helps make tangible that it's really your time is the denominator of everything. It is the ultimate resource that you have. And the art of leverage is really, it's about increasing your impact, but that is impact over time. Like that's the denominator. You want to live a good life. You want to achieve the things you want to achieve. You want to have the enjoyable, subjective, you know, internal experiences that you want, and leverage is sort of the art of getting what you want out of all those things and arranging your life so that, you know, at the end of the day, you're spending it the way you want to and having the outcomes that you want.
Yeah. To my knowledge, Naval hasn't been able to find a way to like get any of his time back that he's wasted. And you know, that would be great. I mean, if you could show how to do that, maybe your next book or something, but man, it's pretty impossible. Like once you spend it, it's gone forever. Like you better use it well now.
Yeah. And I mean, and forgiving yourself for that. Right.
Yeah.
But there's no better time to learn than now, you know, for starting to get a feel for, what your time is worth and how you want to spend it. And, you know, it is that the byproduct of making me slightly impatient with, some of the particularly annoying things in life. Yeah. There's really funny stories about Naval, and I can't remember if any of them made it in the final book or not, but there's some story about him being, I think he says like a very unique combination of willful and impatient. And he's like, I am notorious for like, I'll be at a dinner party. I will decide that this is a waste of my time and I don't want to be here. And without saying anything, I will just get up and leave because it's my life and my time and I'll do what I want. And like, is that outrageously rude by common standards? Like, yes. I think by all accounts, yes. But like, it is also there's no better proof that he's like somewhat, it just has a super unique outlook and perspective on like what it means to really own, to be responsible for your own lived experience and be willing to take whatever actions you want to kind of like make that the best thing you can.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, it's your time. It's your life. I mean, time is what your life is made of. And yes, I mean, don't be a jerk. You know, I try to be a jerk. I try to be friendly to people, but like you don't owe them a piece of your life, you know? I try to answer all my emails or comments to like posts or whatever, but you know, they're basically like email is people reaching into your schedule in your life demanding something from you. And it's they don't always have permission to do that or carte blanche to do that, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, when you're raised as polite as it sounds like we were, you know, that there's something like, it's like extends the neighborly feeling of like, no, of course I'm here to help, to like, I totally stand by that. But also there's 100 of those in my inbox, and like, there's only 24 hours in the day, and that's just a hard thing to swallow and get a perspective shift on. But that's also where leverage comes in, right? Like, that problem is also the solution, where you're like, I cannot spend an hour on the phone, you know, on a call with everybody, whoever wants to, as much as I might want to. But I can record, you know, hours and hours, hundreds of hours, more hours than you want to listen to, of me talking about whatever you want to talk to. And I will put it out there and like make it self-serve. And I will do the best I can to share what I've learned with as many people as I possibly can. And you know, that may not always take a one-to-one form, but, you know, I hope it's still perceived as generous and comes off as useful. Right. And I feel like that's the same thing you're doing here too.
Yeah. And it's also made me sort of more patient and more understanding with people busy for me. You know what I mean? Yep. Like, there have been podcast guests that have been like, sorry, I can't make it. And, you know, I don't think I ever would have like been upset with that. Like, it's, you know, shit happens, but it still helps to realize that, you know, I'm trying to claim some of their time, and like, they're allowed to say no. It's not like it's not an indictment of me, you know, necessarily. Yep. Just like, you know, sorry, it's their life.
It's wild out there. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
It's crazy. Yeah.
24 hours in a day. Yeah. Now, so what would you, like, if someone were to come to you one-on-one and ask, like, how do I spot leverage points in my life? How do I sort of develop an eye for it? Where do you sort of, like, complete beginner, where do you start looking for leverage? What's your first move?
Yeah. I mean, the first thing is mindset. So, you know, you kind of talk through some of the things that, you know, how are they valuing their time? The opportunity is low hanging fruit. You talk through like, what are the things that you do the most often? What are the super repetitive tasks that you deal with? What are the biggest opportunities that you see? What is something that you know you should be working on that you're not? You know, to your point earlier, like, what's something that you're doing that like you hate to do? That like, it's not all like, you know, down to the minutes. It's also down to kind of like energy management. You know, like, there's stuff that I just have no patience for, that like outsourcing it, even though it only saves me, you know, 10 minutes, it saves me an hour of like mental angst about how I spend that 10 minutes, which is like one of those, like, it's totally intangible, but real things. I think it's really important to, when you're just starting to kind of like get your head around this, it's important to like take baby steps and start to feel the tailwind of leverage working for you. So like very, very early in our course, I think it's like the second lesson, even right after welcome, it's like, go do something immediately. I don't care how small it is, but like set up one Zapier automation, you know, put $100 into, you know, into like Coinbase and set it to like have a staking yield on it, and watch, you know, the thousandth decimal place like click over every second, and just like start to get a feel for the fact that something is working for you while you sleep. Because if you've never felt that before, it is really, it's hard to believe it's there. It's the same as the compounding. Like, it's hard to believe that, you know, that 1 cent of interest every month matters or whatever. But you want to start that feedback loop of like, I spent an hour to do this. It saved me 20 minutes this week. And by the end of the month, I start to feel really good about that. And as soon as I watch that automation run, I feel great. Or as soon as I watch that capital return, I feel great. Or, you know, outsource one task on Fiverr. It'll take you 5 minutes to post it. You'll get a bunch of stuff. Like, start really small and start practical immediately. You know, one of the bigger exercises we do is sort of like doing an inventory of all the leverage that you have. So this comes a little later, but it's one of the big aha moments. It's kind of like doing a map of your current leverage. And so we do, you know, your tools, your products, your people, and your capital. What do you have available to you? What's currently deployed, like actively working, you know, what's available, but not yet sort of engaged, and then where you want to be in the future. And I do this exercise quarterly, just looking at what's out there. And it's like, oh, I've got, you know, it's almost a way to calculate your net leverage. You're like, I got 30 podcast episodes out there. And so I've got, you know, 30 little digital clones who are working in these specific purposes. I've got this standard operating procedure, and like, this is something my EA is running. And I've got this, like, you can kind of look at this mountain. The course is called Building a Mountain of Leverage, and you can watch these new, you know, that's how I think of my work. I think of it like adding new levers and extending the levers that are already there. And every quarter there's like this, you know, reminder process to like, look at your life this way and reorient your work towards either adding new levers or extending the levers that are there. And in this way, like whatever you do, you know that your work this quarter is setting you up to have a bigger quarter the quarter after, and a bigger quarter the quarter after that, and a bigger quarter the quarter after that. And you avoid as much of the work as you can that is, you know, one in, one out. I'll have to do this the exact same way another time in the future. And you see the really, really great businesses, or even the really successful individual people who, you know, you can sort of dissect their career using this framework, and you can just watch the leverage get sort of built and added and built and added and grown and compounded until, you know, they're on this mountain of leverage. I think, you know, I think Oprah's an incredible example. I think Joe Rogan's a great example. I think the, Chip and Joanna Gaines are a great example. Like, you can look at Elon Musk's career this way. You can look at Warren Buffett's career this way. You can break all these things down. Like, what are the types of leverage that they use? How did they come about? Who did they hire? Who did they have around them? You could like, one of the places this clicked actually was, reading the back of the acknowledgments in Ray Dalio's first book, Principles. So, you know, you read Principles, excellent book.
Yeah. I read reading his new one right now. It's so good.
Yeah. It, you know, there's one name on the front of the book and you're like, wow, Ray Dalio's an incredible talent. And then you read the acknowledgments in the back of the book and there's 60 names. There's like, I'd like to thank my three personal assistants. I'd like to thank, he literally has people working for him who are called Ray's leveragers, distinct from his personal assistants. And they, and then, you know, I'd like to thank the people that head up my teams and manage my funds. Like, you know, no one who is achieving the superhuman is doing it alone. And if you really like start to try to look at the mountain that they're standing on and the leverage that they've built around them, you can see an incredible amount of this, and you'll start to like, it gives you x-ray vision a little bit, and you start to like see the blueprints of these businesses and these success stories. And you're kind of like, oh, I understand how this comes together. Yeah. And like, that's, we do a lot of that in the course, just trying to break that stuff down and understand how it happens.
Mm-hmm. It's an iceberg. I mean, the top of the iceberg above water is the person, but then 90% of it is like the,
exactly. Right? Exactly.
Like
every biography like that you read after you put this idea in your head, like I'm now like jotting in the margins. I'm like, oh, this was tool leverage. Like I just read Arnold Schwarzenegger's, which I really, really liked. Oh, yeah. He's an amazing example because he just started from absolute zero. Right.
Yeah. I love the title of his autobiography. Total
Recall. Total Recall. Yeah, amazing.
Like right on.
Yeah.
But, like I never skip the acknowledgements. And actually one of the notes that I took from the Almanac was from your acknowledgements, and I thought this was pretty funny. Funny enough to mention here, you say you're all wonderful friends who became extremely helpful advisors to me throughout this book building and publishing process. Without you, I'd still be Googling things and mumbling curses. that was pretty funny and like pretty true, right?
True, man. Dude, publishing a book is hard. There's a bunch of a bunch of stuff that you don't know how to do, and it is really, really helpful to have somebody who's been through this just spend 20 minutes answering your stupid questions that takes 6 hours to Google. Google up an answer, and even then you're not sure if you believe it. And I owe a lot to the people back there. I mean, Emily Holdman was one, James Clear was another, who were just like really, Max Olson, who did the letters of Warren Buffett, is a friend and like inspiration for me in creating this, and super, super helpful in clearing, macheting aside the brush of book publishing and being like, come on, here's the way, you can do it. It's like, there's a path through the woods here. You can do it.
Yeah. One of the things I've always, I heard this speech by Will Smith like years ago, and he says the two keys to life are running and reading. And he said reading is one of the keys to life because there are no new problems. Like any problem that you're facing or challenge you're experiencing, there's someone else who has already faced that problem, solved it, gone a little bit of the way towards solving it, and written about it in a book that you can read in a few hours and then apply it immediately to solve whatever problem it is. That there are people who have done it before. There are who like out there, like who else can do this for me that so I don't have to, so I can free up my time to do what I do best, you know?
Yeah. It seems like every great, you know, every wise person that I've listened to has some version of that. You know, Charlie Munger's like, you know, make friends among the imminent dead. And Naval's like, you know, ancient problems require ancient solutions. And there's just a lot of, there's a lot of value in those books, man.
Totally. It sort of, it leads into one other thing, and we'll wrap this up a little bit because I want to sort of respect your time a little bit.
just a little bit.
Value it at $1,000 a minute.
You'll get an invoice later. Yeah.
Right. Okay. Specific knowledge. I feel like that is one of the key ideas from this book that I don't think a whole lot of people understand, but they should, and they easily could. So maybe just a few minutes about what specific knowledge is and how it ties into leverage.
Yeah. I love how prominent specific knowledge is in Naval's frameworks. And I find it liberating for myself. And I think for a lot of other people, because it's really easy to spend. I think the default mode for a lot of analytical people, especially, is I want an outcome. Let me look at who achieved that outcome and follow their path. You know, you want to be rich, study Buffett, become a value investor, do this. And it like may or may not actually stem from your innate skills, interests, and talents at all. And one guaranteed way to fail is to try to like kind of become someone else and try to follow a path that worked for them because of who they are and what they're interested in and what they love to do. If you hate the gym, but you want to be a like famous movie star, like do not try to do it the way The Rock did, because it's not going to work for you. So it really, I appreciate that through all the frameworks, it really starts with specific knowledge. And specific knowledge, to loosely define, is that combination of your inherent skills, abilities, and talents. You know, Naval says some of it is genetic, some of it is nature, and some of it is nurture, and some of it is just kind of the experiences that you have happened to have in life, you know, whether those were intentional or not, like whether they were good or bad or not, like, you know, the impetus that got Naval to start AngelList was actually like, as he was going through it, I think one of the hardest times of his life and one of the most shitty, unfair things that ever happened, but it gave him that experience and, you know, the scars and the perspective and the hard earned wisdom to go and start this company. So, you know, and that is not to say like, if you haven't walked some specific path, you know, you're screwed. Like everyone has a specific knowledge. It is just your task to figure out what that is. And you see somebody like, you know, Jocko Willink or whatever, like using his very specific walk path. That was another one where it's like the stories of what happened is his career actually really tragic and sad. But he has turned that into, you know, lessons well learned and things that he can teach other people. I shouldn't use all like creators or whatever, you know, as an example in this. Who's another? Josh Wolf is an investor who's like a good example of, you know, sort of he was deeply interested in new technologies and sci-fi stuff and like became a very unique kind of frontier venture capitalist. He didn't try to build, you know, Sequoia or Andreessen Horowitz because that's not, you know, that wasn't the set of opportunities and skills available to him. So, you know, Naval talked about like, you know, how to, and I get questions too, like how do you develop your specific knowledge? And you can do an amount of reflection and journaling and try to figure out sort of, you know, some of the questions that are helpful here is like, what do people come ask you for help with all the time? Yeah. The people around you are maybe better at recognizing it than you are. Like ask your friends, ask your parents, you know, what are the things that you did as a kid? Like very naturally, like, you know,
what's your specific knowledge?
It's a question that is very fair and that I wish I had a better answer to. Let me talk through it a little bit. So I have, as a kid, I was always like creating and writing. So I like have little books that I like would staple together and I would like write comic books and write books, when I was a little kid. So I've always been a reader and a writer. You know, we grew up in a very like small business household. So I was getting paid, like I was like selling candy out of my locker because I found I could like buy a pack of Airheads at Costco for like 5 cents an Airhead and sell them at school for 50 cents an Airhead. You know, I got paid to give kids rides to school and high school and in college. I was building websites for companies. So it was just like kind of constantly like entrepreneurial and mildly creative. And then I spent 10 years in the tech world and, you know, 6 living in San Francisco. And I was around a lot of, you know, a lot of my friends sort of became technology founders and early stage employees and investors. And that is like a world that I really love because it's kind of the mix of entrepreneurship and sci-fi and what the future might look like and really like applying technology to deploy it to create change in people's actual life. And so that is like the combination of all my skills and interests. And it's kind of, I don't know, my job is sort of job, quote unquote, is sort of like organically developing at the moment. And it is becoming some mix of like, you know, writer and curator and researcher and investor and, you know, teacher and whatever else sort of emerges here.
That's exciting. It's always a process of becoming, you know, I like that.
Yeah. I'm trying to kind of create some space in my life to like let that organically emerge, rather than like be in too much of a hurry to like redefine, you know, my career, you know, through the same mistake I outlined before of just kind of like choosing something to work for somebody else that looks cool on them and being like, yeah, I'll just take that off the mannequin and put it on. Like I'm trying to weave my own cloth a little bit.
Yeah. One of the things Deval says in the book is, you know, most of life is a search for who and what needs you the most, you know, which is a good lens to approach it in. You know, like there's so many, so many opportunities. You just have to sort of pour them in. You sort of make the path by walking, which it sounds like is what you're doing, you know, which is exciting and just it's totally open, which is, you know, super cool.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, you have to tolerate a little ambiguity, which not everybody is good at, but I've had a little training with in the startup world, but, it is rewarding when it comes together and it does feel like, you know, when you can build your own house, it feels great to live in it and, it suits you a little better. So, but I'm under no illusion that I'll ever be permanently answered either. So I'm just like ready to let that evolve.
Yeah, no, for sure. One example of this that I liked, and then we'll wrap it up, is Scott Adams, creator of Dope. Mm-hmm. I've always been a fan of his books, and I think he said it's how to fail at everything and still win big.
Yep,
one of his books, and he said that, you know, instead of trying to be in the top 1% of one thing, it's much better to be in the top 10 or 15% or 25% in two or more things and combine that. Mm-hmm. And that's much more specific, right? And I mean, he said that like he's not the best artist, but he's pretty good. So he's like up there in terms of cartoonists, and he's not funniest, but he is pretty funny. He's funnier than most people. And the combination, the intersection of those two skills built his entire career. He used that, he leveraged that, if you will, to branch off into more. So, you know, it's a process of becoming that. You're right. It never really finishes. I don't think, you know, like there's nothing that I can say that, you know, that's my specific knowledge now and forever. It's always going to be, you know, expand.
Yeah.
And I mean, Viktor Frankl, Holocaust survivor, Man's Search for Meaning, one of my favorite books of all time. He didn't put it in these terms, but his sort of specific knowledge was helping other people find their specific knowledge. You know, that's something like a need that needs to be filled as well.
Do you have an answer for that? Who, you know, search for who or what needs you the most?
No. You'll find I don't have many answers. I'm full of questions, but not many answers.
That's what the books are for.
Exactly right. I go where I'm needed, you know, try to be helpful where I can. And I look to what I can give as opposed to what I can take. And, you know, when I started to do that, that's when my whole life started to change, you know, and like once, like I got everything that I needed, and now it's sort of like all bonus, you know, if you can help the people around you to win, I think that's so rewarding.
So that's almost the same question, right? So like, you know, who or what needs you the most is not too dissimilar from, you know, how can I most effectively give? Right. Yeah. So if you've answered that question, maybe you're better off than you think you are.
Yeah.
Or on the right track.
Wiser than I know. I think we'll wrap it up now. I want to give the last word to you. Any sort of like closing thoughts that you want to give, and as well, I want you to let everyone know where they can find you, of course, online, what you're working on right now. You've got a new book coming out. You've got a podcast, a new fund. You've got a whole lot of interesting stuff going on. So just take a few minutes. The rest is yours. Tell us about it.
Oh God. I don't know.
Go.
Closing thought. I think, I don't know. I'm like very fired up about this book, Where's My Flying Car, right now. And it's just got me like on a soapbox about how like the combination of, continually improving technology and, ever more effective capitalism can totally like save the world and liberate everybody. So I hope everybody's on board with that. I know it's like a little bit of a hot topic these days, but it is an amazing book, and it kind of shows how within our lifetimes, a second industrial revolution is within reach, which is absolutely beyond imagination for most of us. But you know, we can basically have perfect control over the material world and energy too cheap to meter, and that will really like transform the lives of our species. And that before the industrial revolution, it was very difficult to imagine that we would ever be able to live the way we can now. So it is totally doable, and I hope we all can sort of blow into those sails with some of our effort over the next rest of our lives. So that's my soapbox and what I encourage, and some more of what I'm working on now. I'm going to write a bunch more about that. So all my stuff is on ejorgensen.com. You know, I've got a podcast there. I got a blog there and a newsletter. I spend way too much time on Twitter, and I'm easy to, you know, sort of talk to or DM there or whatever. I'm working on the next book and starting a venture fund that we just opened up for investment. So if you're an early stage entrepreneur, or you just want to get some capital leverage and put some money to work, you can find that at rolling.fund. I don't know. Yeah, it's all on the website. And okay. I appreciate anybody who's made it this far for tolerating our self-indulgent rambles, and I hope we found some way to give you something worthwhile.
Right on. And it's all in the show notes. So, you know,
it's all in the show notes, baby.
That's where it begins, but that's not where it ends. Once you dive into the almanac of the vault, it's a rabbit hole from which you might never recover. So,
I hope the book. Yes, very important. So the book, the book website is navalmanac.com, but it is available for free. Like all the digital versions are available for free there, and the audiobook is available for free on my podcast. So do not feel any pressure to buy it. It's on Amazon, but like you can read the PDF or the Kindle or whatever version there, and we're translated into like, I don't know, almost 20 languages, I think, are in progress. Cool. So. If you just happen to have listened to an hour and a half of an English podcast and you need a translation into a different language for a book, you can find it on navalmanac.com.
Cool. Man, thanks so much, Eric. I really enjoyed talking to you, and I really appreciate you stopping by High Existence Podcast. It's really cool to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for reaching out. I really enjoyed this. Thanks, Matt.
Yeah. Right on. Cheers.